Everybody, this is the sixth lecture in our course on Asian Buddhist women, organized by the Numata Center of Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg in collaboration with the Dharma Drum Institute of Liberal Arts in Taiwan. And it is my great pleasure today to welcome Ranjini Obeyesekara, who will be speaking to us on the topic of Buddhist women in Sri Lanka. Ranjini Obeyesekara obtained her PhD in English literature from the University of Washington, Seattle. She taught in the English departments at the University of Peradeniya, Sri Lanka, and after moving to the United States at the University of California, San Diego. For the last 10 years, she was a lecturer in anthropology at Princeton University, where she taught courses in South Asian literature and culture. She has published extensively in foreign and local journals and has translated Sinhala prose and poetry for anthologies. Her published books include A Treasure in the Forest and Other Stories, 1969, Sinhala Writings and the New Critics, 1974, A Grief Ago, 1991, Jewels of the Doctrine, Translations from the Saddharma Ratnavalia, 1991, Sri Lankan Theatre in a Time of Terror, Political Satire in a Permitted Space, 1999, and Portraits of Buddhist Women, Stories from the Saddharma Ratnavalia, 2001. She is presently editor of a translation of the 14th century text of the Sinhala Jataka stories, which the first volume of 200 stories is completed and awaiting publication. Now she retired, she lives in Canby and Manhattan. And with that much for introduction, I hand over to Ranjini Obeyesekara and very grateful for her to be part of this course.
It is a great pleasure and a great honor to be asked to speak today on this lecture series. I'm afraid I have never done this before, talking to a machine and going through all the intricacies of this. So forgive me if I don't quite know how to handle it or what to do with it. I may just resort to reading my text if everything fails. So I'm very willing to be interrupted at any time when you're bored, and I'm also willing to stop and answer questions if you have anything to ask. But for the main part, I think I will just read what I have or try to introduce it in some little less boring way. Okay, my first caveat is I hesitate to make the title of my paper was Buddhism and its Impact on Sri Lankan Women, Thumbnail Sketches from Texts and Personal Observations. Now, I hesitated to make a statement like this in the first part of my title because it implies generalizations of an almost untenable order. I feel that neither Buddhism nor its impact on women, whether in Sri Lanka or elsewhere, can be described as fixed or unchanging categories, especially in terms of generalization. How a religion like Buddhism is observed and practiced is necessarily subject to a wide range of differences. This is especially so as Buddhism, unlike several other religions, does not prescribe formalized rules for secular social living and leaves a lot of space for the inclusion of national cultural variations in dress, foods, customs, rituals, etc. As I see it, its central focus, and this is perhaps just my individual take on it, is as a path and an aid to handling the ups and downs of samsaric existence. And this such a position can lead to a certain degree of equanimity, or one might say happiness. In Buddhist terms, this can only come with an awareness and acceptance of the fundamental truth of the transiency of all things. Once that is accepted or internalized, one then must learn to cultivate detachment, or what they claim as unattachment, to that which is transient. It seems so logical that unattachment to that which is transient must necessarily result in a kind of equanimity and compassion, I would say, towards other beings. The details of secular living, what one eats, how one dresses, where and how and when one worships, or what rituals one observes, all that is not regulated by the religion and are therefore not too important. Thus, Buddhist women have throughout the centuries had a great deal of space within which to operate, and the differences therefore are legion. That's why I said that any kind of generalization, any kind of attempt to compartmentalize or categorize has to be taken with a lot of reservation, and the complexities have to be introduced. Now, given that caveat, let me proceed. As Buddhism developed over time and spread over large parts of the world, it has necessarily affected secular living and social life and customs, and developed structures and norms that, while they may vary from country to country and person to person, have yet taken on a certain general characteristics. These have evolved within the broad parameters of the Buddha's doctrine. The emphases change with changing time and the changing world. But basically, there are some basic norms that seem to appear in almost all Buddhist societies. Now, what are some of these norms, and how have they developed and over time? Let us look at some of these. One, and the most striking in my opinion, is that Buddhism introduced a certain fundamental egalitarianism between the sexes, an acceptance in the very early stages of the development of the religion that the highest goal of becoming an arhat and achieving nirvana was open equally both to men and women. And this gave an enormous boost to the status of women, especially since Buddhism in the early especially among Buddhists in early Indian and Sri Lankan society. The Theri Gee, or songs of the nuns, the songs of the sisters as they have been translated, speak of this freedom and sense of liberation from the restrictions on women that existed in the Brahmanic society of ancient India in the Buddha's time. The fact that actually a collection of these statements, these poetic utterances, these personal experiences, given in terms of short poems or little discourses, and that the poems together with their identities, were included in what later became composed as the Buddhist doctrinal canon. And this inclusion indicates that the concept of egalitarianism between the sexes was established very early in Buddhism and in Buddhist thought, and accepted by the earliest formulators of the canon. It is, I believe, also the first time that the writings of women were included in the doctrinal canon of a major religion. However, the power and pervasiveness of social restrictions and pressures on women extant in the Buddha's time is reflected in the fact that it is said that the Buddha himself at first hesitated to establish an order for women on the model of the order he established for monks. Thus, though the highest goal of becoming an arahat was open equally to women, establishing of an order for nuns seems to have been a harder proposition. Then too, we are told that very strict rules of hierarchy vis-à-vis the order of monks were laid down for the nuns. Now, perhaps such concessions were necessitated for the survival of an organization, in itself a revolutionary, very revolutionary one, in what was a in what happened to be at that time a patriarchal Brahmanic society. Or perhaps these may have been later additions by monks wishing to maintain the status quo of earlier times. It's hard to say because it's happened and this is all stories that have come down to us. All we know is that these rules were formulated very early in the history of Buddhism and do suggest a certain undermining of the more fundamental concept of egalitarianism that has never been refuted doctrinally, I don't think, anywhere in the Buddhist world. It is equally interesting that once established, the order of nuns did flourish both in India from the Buddha's time and in Sri Lanka since the 3rd century BCE when it was first introduced and established. References in the Sri Lankan chronicles, rock inscriptions, commentarial literature bear witness to this fact, and I have as footnotes several sources from which you can gather, from which I gather this information. The Sri Lankan chronicles also state that when the Thera Mahinda, son of King Asoka, on his visit to the King of Sri Lanka, preached to the women of the royal household, Queen Anula and her entourage decided to seek ordination. Now, this is a very interesting thing in early Buddhism, if in fact it is correct, but it does appear in the chronicles. And because of this request by the queen, Sangamitra, daughter of the Emperor Asoka, was then sent to Sri Lanka and did establish the order for nuns. The king Devanampiyatissa then built a large monastic complex for his queen and her entourage. And it was called the Upasika Vihara. And later he built another smaller one called the Hatthalaka Vihara, where supposedly the nun Sangamitra preferred to reside. The order of bhikkhunis in Sri Lanka grew through the centuries and kings continued to support them and build residences for them. These bhikkhuni vihara were also recipients of great wealth in land and property, and that had to be administered by many employees. Many of the major monastic land complexes, such as the Mahavihara and the Abhayagiri Vihara, also had residences for women. So they were very much part of the Buddhist establishment in Sri Lanka in the early years. The chronicles also refer to individual nuns of great repute and learning, and special mention to good preachers among them. Chinese records state that 8 similar nuns reached Nanking, China in 425 CE. And I quote, "They seem to have made such a deep impression there on Chinese Buddhist women that 3 more were invited to start a bhikkhuni order there," unquote. And again, I won't bother to read the references, but they are there in my text. The order of nuns now lasted till around the 10th century. Thereafter, there is no further mention of them in the chronicles, and they probably disappeared with the disruptions that occurred with the Chola invasion of Sri Lanka around the 10th century CE. Fuller research has to be done into the underlying causes as to why and how this happened. As of now, we only know that the order died out. The order of monks, however, survived into the 18th century, when they too underwent the inroads of colonialism and went into periods of abeyance. The order was later revived by ordination through monks invited by the kings from other, and invited from other Asian Buddhist countries like Burma and Siam. And the organizations, the monk organizations that now exist are called the Burmese, two of them are the Burmese order and the Siamese order, Siam Nikaya and the Burma Nikaya. Ironically, the present resistance, even today in 2016, to the revival of the order of nuns in Sri Lanka through ordination by nuns in China or elsewhere, comes mainly from the very monk orders that were themselves revived by ordination from abroad. Such resistance, I think, is an indication of the pervasiveness of patriarchal ideas that have seeped back into the Sri Lankan society and Sri Lankan monasticism, especially among the monks. Now, I have been told by Bhikkhuni Dhammadina that there is a Siam Nikaya organization called the Dambulla Nikaya, which has agreed to and does ordain nuns, women, as in the order of nuns. I don't know enough about it, so I can't discuss it at length, but that is perhaps the first group that has been officially authorized or officially a part of the established monk orders. But the irony of it is that the monks seem to have forgotten that most their orders were all re-established by ordination from abroad. And so the rejection of ordination by nuns from China or nuns from Taiwan seemed to be unacceptable. With the establishment of the order of nuns, education and learning became accessible and readily taken up by women. Since Buddhism stressed the importance of an individual's acquisition of knowledge and understanding of the doctrine in order to achieve the highest goals of religion, the acquisition of knowledge through study and the need for education for both men and women became another given in Buddhist societies, very early in Buddhist societies. There are references in early Buddhist literature to women whose learning and oratorical skills were significant enough to challenge monks and scholars all over the subcontinent. And I can refer to the story of Kundalakesi, who walked around Namadeva, they say, calling up on people to meet her in debate, contest her in debate, and that when she arrived, monks and senior scholars disappeared, they fled, because her reputation was so strong. There's also a story in the Jataka story, the Chullakalinga Jataka, number 300 of volume 1, where four Lichavi women learned 500 topics of debate from their mother, a wandering ascetic, and 500 topics of debate from their father, who was a giant debater. The two had met and were found equal in debate. They were met in the Lichavi kingdom, this is how the story goes, and they were found to be equal in debate. So the Lichavis decided, if these two get married, we can get even more scholarship among the people of the among the Lichavi. So they did, and they had four daughters and one son, according to the story. And the four daughters learned 500 tricks of learning from the mother and 500 from the father, and then decided that they would wander around the kingdoms of India, so the story goes, debating and meeting people or contesting their knowledge, checking their knowledge against that of others. Then there are other stories of women like Kujutra. And again, the reference I've given is in my collection of stories from the Sadharma Ratnavalia, where she listened. She was a maid for Queen Sama, And she was sent to listen. They couldn't go, but she was sent to listen to the sermons of the Buddha, came back and preached to her, to the queen and the entourage. And it's interesting that she's described as having decided to preach to the queen and others seated like a Buddha. The brief passage suggests a sense of confidence and status that her knowledge of the doctrine gave her. She, who had been a queen's maid, could now come, sit like a Buddha and teach the queen and her entourage the doctrine. There were also, of course, stories of women like Visakha, a woman with great intelligence and managerial skills, who controlled a large complex household, very much like probably a modern business corporation. This ready acceptance of education for women and control over land and property was and still is an important feature among Sri Lankan Buddhists. Two of the most important pieces of legislation passed by the Sri Lankan government after independence from Britain was a Free Education Act that provided education throughout school and university for men and women and free health care for all its people. Both, one might say, strongly influenced by the Buddhist social concerns as reflected in the early established monastic complexes that had education and health facilities for all its members and for the laity. The eagerness to acquire an education still exists today, especially among women in traditional Buddhist areas of rural Sri Lanka. This has been a feature also of many other traditional Buddhist societies in South and Southeast Asia. Today, in modern Sri Lanka, it is reflected in the fact that over 50% or more of all students in all the universities are women. Parents, even from the poorest rural families, eagerly educate both their sons and their daughters and are ready and willing, if they have the talent, to let them enter any of the professions or seek employment in any sphere. This is in marked contrast to the situation in Hindu India or among Sri Lankan officers. In Hindu India in the past, I think it's changing even in India today, or among Sri Lankan Muslim women, or the Tamil Hindu women in the plantation areas, where their religious and social codes produce serious constraints on education and employment of women in the outside world. The absence of restrictions and the ready access to education and to employment outside the home for women resulted in educated women moving into the professions as doctors, lawyers, administrators, managers, business companies, etc. There was never a glass ceiling that they had to overcome, nor was there any discrimination in their salaries. Equal pay for equal work in all the professions and the bureaucracies was an accepted norm in Sri Lanka, long before it had to be fought for and won in the Western world. It is probably also no accident that the first woman, first ever woman Prime Minister of a country was a Buddhist woman from the small island of Sri Lanka. America has still to come up with a woman president. Nor is it an accident that after 400 years of colonial domination, having gained independence in 1947, the middle years of the 20th century, that it saw the presence of educated women from all levels of society move into the highest echelons of professional, academic, and political life. It was not that they gave up their obligations to their families and the commitments that it involved. It was rather that the support from husbands, parents, and extended family was solidly behind the working woman, enabling them to pursue their multitasking activities. This, we were three girls and one brother in the family, and there was never a question about not going to university if we made it at the exams. We did, and as soon as we graduated, we assumed that we would look for jobs, and we did. It is true that we came from a fairly traditional Buddhist home in the hill country, as yet not overly influenced by Western Victorian values that had spread with colonialism over sections of the more affluent upper classes living in the coastal areas. Looking back, however, I now remember that for some of my classmates, whose parents were from affluent westernized families, going to the university was not an option. Their parents preferred to have them married instead to men of their class and social status. They were, however, rather few in number, if I remember them, maybe a handful in a class that all the rest were very keen to go to university. In my time, the 50s and 60s, and that's a long time ago, women was a strong presence in the universities in all fields, science, medicine, engineering, law, and the humanities. Women participated in sports, extracurricular activities such as drama and debate, and in student politics. The best, whatever their field, competed with the men and other women to enter academia, research institutions, professional or administrative positions. Competition was fair and sex was never an issue. Now, however, at the turn of the century, things seem to be changing. I'm told by my daughter that while large numbers of women still come to the university from the rural areas, the general atmosphere is far less open to women. Few, if any, women now contest or hold office in university societies or student union or the student union. That is now considered male terrain. Few have goals beyond completing their degrees and possibly getting some kind of a clerical job in the lower echelons of the administrative service, or with luck, as a school teacher, preferably close to home. This subtle growth or re-emergence of patriarchal has been attributed by scholars to the influence of Victorian values into post-colonial Buddhism, what my husband Ganath has said, Protestant Buddhism. Yet another feature is that growing members among them, among these university graduates, or people who have an education, women who have an education, especially as they move into the middle or low middle class society, do not take employment outside the home, as husbands prefer that they do not do so. This is a marked shift in social expectations and norms, especially among the middle and low middle classes, where formerly husbands, parents and family were all supportive of the working woman. This is less so now. Reasons for the shift are probably many, and no real studies have been done on the subject. One can only speculate. Perhaps one reason is the importance of money in today's globalized economy. Thus, to be supported by one's husband and not have to earn is seen as a mark of rising social status. The influence of the media, its advertisements, and the world of consumerism and excitement it has produced has opened up for women and provides alternative areas of involvement and satisfaction to compete, to compensate for not being able to follow their interests or academic careers. There is also perhaps underlying fears on the part of present-day husbands that places of employment can expose women in this age of changing social mores and media-generated values to engage in extramarital affairs. This may not have been an issue in the past. Protestant Buddhism, that is slowly taking over the middle-class world, they become matters of increasing concern. It seems to apply especially to the wives of soldiers. Military men are now a sizable part of the youth population and are seen as very eligible husbands for young women from rural areas. Soldiers have steady jobs, life is not at risk anymore, the war is over, they have a fair amount of money and social status, as men in uniform. But they have often still to work in various capacities in distant areas. Their sexual needs are probably satisfied on occasion by women of those areas, but that probably intensifies their fears about their own wives left behind. Ironically, the opposite is the case among the very poor, mostly from rural, provincial, agricultural areas. There, the pressure by husbands and families for women to go abroad for work is very great and very intense. Husbands are the first to encourage their wives to go to the Middle East for work as domestic aides. There is a huge labor market for them in these parts of the world, with fairly good salaries attached. In spite of increasing reports about the hardships women undergo in these countries, and the physical and mental and sexual abuse many of them are often subject to, yet the significant numbers of women who leave their husbands and young children behind and go abroad for the money they can earn is considerable. Today, the largest amount of foreign exchange for the country is earned not by exports or manufactured goods, but by the remittance of these women. While at one level, this push to send their women abroad can be seen as a form of male exploitation for the money that they bring, yet at another level, it is a mark of the remarkable independence, courage, and resilience of these Sri Lankan women that they are willing to go alone to unknown lands, often without knowing the language, and are willing to work even without a smattering of English and face whatever comes. Sometimes there are success stories. Sometimes the situation is so bad that the results are disastrous for all concerned. Increasing research and studies of the problems of these women is being done, but solution be found. It is one of the few employment opportunities for unskilled women in this country. So they need the jobs and the government needs their money. I will now give a few examples from my personal knowledge of the changing situations as they impact on individual women and how far the traditional norms and values that have come with Buddhism have impacted on them. Shall I go ahead with the example? The mother of two daughters, now in her late 50s, worked all her life as a daily help at home and earned enough to educate both daughters. She proudly claimed that all she earned was for the education of the daughters. Neither one made it to the university, which is increasingly competitive. But they are both intelligent and confident and went to computer classes, qualified in it, and both took on small jobs. Both of them found their partner's website, Kapua.com, which now is a very popular marriage broker and has removed the old-fashioned marriage brokers who made the marriages for young women in families. It is an innovative, independent, increasingly popular mode, unlike the old forms of arranged marriage. One daughter married a man from the Kandy area, the central highlands, as the map will show. And she lives close to her maternal family, is determined to keep her job and continue with additional studies. She is now qualified as an English teacher in the village and has started private tuition classes in English and English elocution. Both these jobs are fairly lucrative sources of income, especially since they serve a rural population, and especially since tuition in English is seen by parents now as an important aid to jobs. She has one child and the family all help with childcare, so she can work and continue her studies. The husband also has a small job and is very supportive of the wife's work. Her sister married a man who has a very good income and a good job with a private company and lives in the south of the island. The husband's family owns some land. They are clearly an upwardly mobile, lower middle class family from the southwestern area. Her husband does not want her to work outside the home. The daughter and her mother were both at first not at all happy about this. The mother complained to me that her child's education and training had come to nothing. But in the past few years, the daughter has adjusted to the situation, and the money the husband earns seems to keep her happy and pleased at her rising social status. Even her mother now talks to me about the son-in-law's big salary and the growing affluence of her younger daughter. The next two are examples of another family where the two daughters of parents who had both been at first day workers on a small coconut plant in the central province. The father is very intelligent. He had moved up to becoming the head supervisor in charge of the plantation. Both daughters went to the village school. The older one did not make it in a garment factory near her home. This too is a popular source of employment for young village women, and gives them a certain degree of independence and freedom. A few years later, she married her cross cousin, a well-accepted custom in these areas. However, when she moved to her husband's home, her mother-in-law did not want her to work. The mother-in-law herself went out to work, but did not want her daughter-in-law to do so. Frustrated and upset, after about a year or two, she returned to her parental home. Both parties considered it a divorce. Since the relationship was close, it caused some ill feeling between the two families. But her parents accepted her decision and supported her. Then, about 3 years later, we heard that she had decided to go back to her husband, whom she had liked all along as a cousin. They now have a child, and the question of a job is no longer an issue with them. The younger daughter was very bright, very intelligent, and did get entrance to the university, the first one from the village school to do so. Though we provided additional support for her at the university and advised her to do any subject of interest and said we would help her to go on to graduate work in any profession she chose, clearly the atmosphere and the general mood in the university had changed. Neither she nor her friends, after 3 years in university, were interested in further studies. They wanted to leave, get a small job in the provincial administration, and perhaps find a husband. She was very frustrated after graduation, as jobs did not come easily. She had acquired no special skills or interests at the university, and so her competitive edge was small when it came to jobs. Depressed and discouraged, she too went to work in a garment factory, and the entire family was disappointed. Finally, her father was told that if he would speak to the politician for the region, she might get a job. We do not know what happened, but bribe-taking was rampant at the time, especially among small-time politicians, in the provinces. We were told the father met one of them and the daughter finally got a small job in the bureaucracy of a provincial administration. She is now married, lives with her parental family. The grandmother takes care of the child while she goes to work. She seems to be happy and her job at her job and has no further ambitions to continue with her studies or any kind of rising in the system. These are isolated cases in different parts of the country, but they do suggest some points of interest. All four women coming from Buddhist families took it for granted that they would get an education. Their families supported them. All four ended up married and now have families. One from a central area around Kandy continued happily and enthusiastically employed, involved with entrepreneurial work that is creating for herself interesting work. The sister married in the south was not encouraged to work, but seems to have accepted the situation and quite content. Of the other two sisters from the rural area of the central province, one was not allowed to work after her marriage and decided to return to her parental home. It was accepted as a divorce in terms of the traditional pre-colonial law of the area, termed as Kandyan law. Later, when she decided to go back to her husband, that too was accepted without legal hassle, because if you choose to go back, you can go back. Her younger sister had the most potential, and in an earlier age and time, would probably have risen fast in a profession. But the world around her at the university in the 1990s did not foster any such ambitions. She went through a 3-year degree in the humanities, acquired no special interest or skills, and now that she finally has a job, is happy with this. One doesn't know for how long. If one goes to any government or provincial or municipal office in the country today, the clerks and minor staff are mainly women, with no real interest in the subject or the project, but sufficiently educated to file letters, take orders, yet unwilling to take decisions on issues as it endangers their jobs. It is a sad commentary on the access to education that Buddhism brought to Sri Lanka. One might attribute this change to the increasing authoritarianism and power of politicians in almost every sphere of work and the changes that came over the society as a result. One other generalization one might make about how Buddhism impacted on the lives of women is with regard to law, the ownership of property, and the rights of women in marriage. In traditional Sri Lankan society, or as it operated in the Kandyan area, where Buddhism was still the practiced religion of the king and the people until the British conquest in 1815, it was followed by a colonial administration and colonial legal system. During that period, marriage was a secular, not a religious contract or a legal contract. It could be one of two forms: a legal marriage, where the daughter left the parental home to form a nuclear household and was given her share of the property to take with her, not as a dowry, but in her name, in her own name. The other was a binna marriage, where a family had no male heirs and one of the daughters, often the youngest, was given in a binna marriage. This meant she continued to live in the parental home and the husband just moved in. He had no rights to the property, which went to the wife and the children of that marriage. Children took the grandfather's family name, and the main home and mulgedra and property went to that daughter and her progeny. A father's gift to a daughter, even in a legal marriage, was not a dowry as in India, or a bride price as in some African societies. It was a gift of land and jewelry given to her and the property deeded in her name and not that of the husband. If she chose to end her marriage for whatever reason of incompatibility, she had the right to return to her parental home and her property remained with her. If her parents were dead and the eldest sibling had inherited the parental home, he had to accept her right to return and her share in the property of her parents. Since marriage, in traditional Buddhist terms, was not a sacramental but a social contract, divorce was easy and did not involve the law or the religion. If a woman returned to her parental home and chose not to go back to her husband for a certain fixed period of time, then both partners could consider the marriage over and make new social contracts. This is still the recognized law in that part of the island, which was known as the Kandyan Kingdom and is referred to as Kandyan law, and can still operate on that basis and do. Today, Buddhism is a state religion in Sri Lanka and practiced in many different ways. Among the wealthy, giving of dana to monks and ceremonies like pirit and pinkan to celebrate religious or public events are popular both in the family and in schools and workplaces. Their scale varies with the degree of affluence of the organizers or organizations that sponsor such events.
Maybe you could explain what pirit and pinkan is for.
Okay, yes. Pirit are ceremonies where monks chant the text, from the text, which people believe brings protection and blessing on the listener. So pirit is often very popular form in public institutions, in places, political situations, in families, births, deaths, not so much deaths, but births, marriages, etc., for a kind of inclusion of blessings into, bringing blessings into lay life. The pinkan are similarly a part of the pirit sometimes, and but sometimes without, but these are large public gifts of food and money, food and gifts, objects, to monks as an act of merit. And once again, it has become a very popular public event for prime ministers, ministers, to celebrate birthdays with such events, to celebrate occasions, political occasions, with huge gifts to the Sangha. So pirit pinkan are public, have become very much public events. They're also private events with families. You have them to celebrate and a birth, to bring blessings for a pregnancy. You have it prior to a wedding. Especially as the religion somehow has become more sacramental. The need, when you compare it with Christianity, for example, or various other religions that have similar situations at different stages of their life. Buddhists too have formed, you know, so for example, weddings, which were never religious events, now have a purohita who come and chant blessings. And, you know, things that were never considered, but was just secular, an arrangement between families, where the two families got together in a marriage and celebrated the marriage with a wedding feast, have now become public events of a very different order. And a religious element has been incorporated into it, even though still today monks don't participate in those events, if they have. Most monks don't. There are, I think, the occasional ones who may do. But their role is mainly for pirit, where they chant from text in order to bring their gifts. They don't participate in weddings and birthday parties or things like that. We don't know for how long, but now they do it. Increasing numbers of who now join groups that teach meditation. Now, this is the other aspect. One is the public aspect, that this dhanas and monks involved in Pirith and Pingham. Their scale varies with the degree of affluence, and even the villagers are now doing it on ever larger and larger scales, and sometimes at great cost to them because they can barely afford to do it on the scale. In all these events, women are often the major participants and take on the major responsibilities for the organization and the preparations. At the village level, male participation is low, so it is with the full moon observations of still. Many women, young and old, are seen dressed in white and going to temples. There, the older ones observe still on full moon day, and still is where you take the 8 precepts rather than the 7 and stay on overnight. A mixed crowd of young and old, young men are conspicuous by their absence at temples, except on public or political events held there. A mixed crowd of young and old do visit temples if they are part of pilgrim groups that go on tours in special buses hired for these events. Women are often the main organizers again of all such ceremonial events among villagers or in the family. So it is also with the increasing numbers who now join groups that teach meditation. Meditation is very much a private activity. The fact that increasing numbers of women are taking to it, whether as a source of solace from personal problems that increasingly beset modern life, or as a serious search for reaching the higher goals of the religion through quiet study and meditation, it is an indication that women of different age groups are exercising their right to independently reach the goals they have set themselves in the manner they choose. In the classes on meditation too, the larger number of meditators are women, older men and monks who at first were not a presence among groups of lay meditators, do now seem to be moving into the sphere. Techniques of meditation were not generally taught as part of the training given to novice monks in Sri Lankan monasteries until relatively recently. Study of the canon, scholarship and teaching through servants were the main foci, unlike in Burma and Thailand, where the tradition of meditation was kept alive in the monasteries. While there has always been a tradition of the vanavasins or forest monks who engaged in meditation but did not teach it, they lived in far from village habitations and were known only to small groups living nearby. The fundamental freedom that Buddhism has given women, whether in Sri Lanka or other Buddhist South Asian countries, is basically the independence to choose how they wish to observe and fulfill and follow the religion, while involvement in public performance of religious rituals is common in the society, it is in no way mandatory. One can participate or need not if one does not wish to. There is no public or private condemnation in either case. Maybe there is great praise for those who participate in such public events, but there is no condemnation of those who do not. So I can choose not to go if I don't go, but there's nothing to stop someone who wants to go from going. In my own family, we consider ourselves Buddhists, but we each operate differently. My husband is in a sense a student and scholar of Buddhism, and as an anthropologist, he is interested. As an anthropologist, he is interested in both in the doctrine and how it is seen and practiced in the day-to-day life of Sinhala Buddhists today. He rarely goes to the temple to worship, nor does he participate in ritual ceremonies, except very occasionally for a close relative or friend. Yet he is a Buddhist and would not label himself otherwise. I, on the other hand, have been brought up in a traditional Buddhist household and do participate in important family ceremonies, respect them and consider that they are an important part of what has kept the religion alive. But for me too, it is the fundamental doctrine of the Buddha that is deeply relevant and meaningful. Trying to cultivate detachment or degree of unattachment as a way of life is not easy, but the effort has enabled me throughout the past 83 years to face the ups and downs of samsaric existence with a modicum degree of equanimity and compassion, which I consider a kind of happiness. While I participate on occasions in rituals and ceremonies, they are not important for me, nor are the concerns of the afterlife or even the doctrine of karma. I neither believe nor disbelieve. I just do not know. Therefore, I do not need to condition my life on the ups and downs of samsaric existence. I do not need to condition my life on the basis of an afterlife that may or may not exist. I am aware that this is a deeply personal understanding of Buddhism, which has worked for me in the conduct of my life. It may not be relevant for anyone else. It may not even be Buddhist. By contrast, my sister and we grew up in the same world, educated in the same school, exposed to the same conditioning, with loved and loving parents, she is a Buddhist in a very different, total sense. She has a brilliant mind, was the top of her class every year in everything she did, right through university. However, over the years, she and her husband moved more and more out of the world of secular society and into a life of meditation and involvement with the Dhamma. She taught herself Pali, is deeply versed in the Dhamma, and has for years been involved in deep meditation. While rituals and ceremonies are not important for her per se, yet she does maintain the spirit behind them is important and practices them for their deeper significance. I see her often offer a dhana to monks in her home, and it is complete in every detail which she personally sees to. The large numbers who participate are looked after in the same way, and I am reminded of Visakha of the text. My sisters and I are very close and each very different. And while we discuss our different perspectives and approaches to the religion, we respect each other's position, accept that we see things differently, and it in no way affects the closeness of our relationship. If one sister lives outside the social world to a large degree, my other sister works tirelessly in the world. A brilliant lawyer and educationist, she has held high office, is respected for her sharp mind, her integrity and unswerving commitment to her work for human rights and the rights of ethnic minorities, children and women. Yet amidst all this, she is a wonderful cook, looked after her husband and brought up 4 children for a sick friend, a needy student or relative. For her, Buddhist rituals in their own way have a certain psychological appeal. She will go to the temple of the tooth relic early in the morning when she visits me in Kandy. Siri Sinkang and other such ceremonies she feels strongly give a certain kind of continuity to tradition, and this she values. In spite of varying ways in which Buddhism has impacted on the individual women I have described, and in spite of what one might also perceive as increasing female religiosity of a public or somewhat superficial kind, yet in a deeper sense, it is women who, whether as individuals or in groups, have kept many of the Buddhist formal traditions alive through time. It is they who have kept alive the egalitarian spirit of Buddhism in a fundamental sense. It is they who have been the backbone of support for the Sangha, and in that sense, enabled the Sangha to keep the religion alive. Thank you very much. I hope I haven't read too fast or that it has not been too boring, but I know there was no choice in the matter because I've never done this before and I'm feeling very, very ill at ease. Okay, how much time?
We have another hour.
going to have very serious repercussions in the coming years. And that's frightening. So let's hope it doesn't come that way. And also the question you asked about the formalities of dress codes that have come in. And that's again the new Buddhism. A new Buddhism which is national, anti-Western, because they feel those are the inroads that are corroding and corrupting our tradition. But of course, what they consider tradition is something that they've worked out for themselves now. And it is a kind of political ethos that is created. You have large-scale performance of rituals, you know, Philip Pinkham, and I think recently the last government would have 1,000 monks were given dana in one situation in the Independence Hall or something, or like that, as the temporary resort. So it becomes, and everyone wants to be seen there, so then it becomes something you have to participate in. So things like that are happening on a large scale. And I think this is so it's becoming so tied up with politics. And somewhere I feel that unless I may be westernized, I may have been influenced by secular states that allow much more openness. But I feel that if you claim to be open to anyone who wants to accept the Buddhist way of life, but the moment you say Singha the Buddhist, you're giving a nationalist identity to it. And I think that's dangerous and self. If that answers your question.
Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Venerable Amala, you have anything to comment on this? Otherwise, I would have another little question.
Is he there?
Yes. So it seems not. Then the other question is perhaps more text-oriented. So you have been working on the Dharma Ratnavalia, and perhaps can say a few words to the participants on how the reception of this text has affected the identity of Sri Lankan Buddhist women, if they identify with the characters in this text, especially with the female characters.
It's interesting. The Sadharma Ratnamalaya and all these early texts, even the Jatakas, were very much part of the cultural tradition of Buddhism, especially in the rural and traditional areas. It's gone out in schools now, it's hardly, people don't know the stories, they don't. But it was part of, you know, you go to your Poyade temple and the stories are told. My Basunya, for example, has some myriad stories that he's just known. And these were means by which the tenets of Buddhism were explained and made understandable to ordinary people. So they knew the stories from Satana, they knew the story of Visakha, they knew the story of this one and that one. Now much less so. I would say that generations of my nieces and nephews have grown up going through school with hardly any knowledge of these stories. And so it didn't impact them in any way, they're not aware of it. I know that there are lots of students who have a few texts which they may have the story, say five stories from the Sadharma Ratnavalaya in simple things, which they have to learn or study for the exam. And there's a kind of distance that comes there. You study for an exam, you forget it the next day. It's like how I studied German when I had to do it for my PhD as a second language. I did it for the exam, I passed the exam, I know never need to use it again, and I forgot it immediately. So it's like that. That is the other way. It's a kind of very slow motion integration of values that come from them. The values of women who could go out and do things, who could go out and, you know, do jobs, do work, do different kinds of things. And in that collection I have of portraits of Buddhist women, what I did was, the first 20 stories I chose for translation, I planned to do the whole of the Sadharma Ratnavalaya, then I realized I'll be dead before I go through 25 stories, because it took so long, it took me about 3 years to do the first 20 stories of the text. This is where I admire the monks and the nuns, who have time to sit and write and translate like you do things. We are caught within this and that and the other, this kamkatolu, as they say, of daily life, and so you don't have it. Anyway, so I did the first prayer. I wanted them to get an idea of how it was related to the Dhammapada. But the other, so I then decided, okay, for the Swiss, I'm not going to do the whole thing. I'll choose stories, all the stories in the Satyamratnavalaya, where the women are the chief characters. So the portraits of Buddhist women from the Satyamratnavalaya are all stories where the women become the chief characters. And I think that produced a different kind of vision for, you know, it restated what Buddhist women were and could do. And I don't think it's even read in Sri Lanka. It's not even sold in the bookstores. I have to bring 20 copies from Sunni when I come and give it to the bookstores and say, sell it at any price you want because I would like it read. But they're not interested, you see. They want commercial books that sell fast. So this kind of thing has not become popular. But I'm sure that if it is read or if it is discussed in some way, in school levels, etc., it will be seen differently. The people will respond to these differently, and they'll affect their lifestyles more closely than they do now. Now it's just an example, but five stories from Satyamratnavalaya, I think, are given in a small booklet, and you have to read them for the exam and pass the exam. That's it. Anyway, that's what I think. I may be prejudiced.
It's been very, very interesting to hear from your own voice.
Personal experience. Yeah. But it is, in fact, I have several young friends who are students, young students and friends. And I keep telling them, you know, go back to the text and translate. Because not only are you translating for the benefit of later generations, but that you learn so much from rereading and textually going through the text closely. And even the Jatakas, you know, it's fascinating. I mean, the Bodhisattva was born in every kind of life, not just animals and humans, but in every status of life. He was a thief, and he was put in prison, he was taken for execution, he was a seducer who took away the queen and took her into a grove of, abducted the queen to a grove of trees in some red cotton trees or something in the forest. So these are experiences, human experiences of life lived, which was expressed in terms of Jataka story. I mean, not all of them are there. There are very many. He's the man, he's the leader, he's the Bodhisattva, he's the one who helps, he's the one who does all the correct things, but there are also the others. So you get a perspective that these are samsaric existences for million years. If you believe, that's the crucial point. But you can read them as stories. You can read them as stories. And I think that's the difference, that you don't have to believe or disbelieve, I think. What I don't know, I don't dismiss as being either wrong or not right. I just say, okay, I don't know. What I don't know doesn't intensely personalize my worldview. What I know, and I know that if you can see the world as transient, and if you can internalize that awareness, and if you can distance yourself from attachment, that helps. That I have seen, and I can see, and I can accept totally. But that what I do in this world can go into my next birth, that is this ring of birth, and that it is. And that what is it that goes, if there is no self, what is it that goes into the next? There's lots of questions that I found hard to come up with. And so, as the Buddha said, sometimes when people ask him what is Nirvana, etc., he says, don't ask the question. When you experience it, you know. So I tell my sister who often says, you have to learn, you have to know this. You can't be so totally disbelief. I say, when I understand and I believe, then it will work. So that's it. personal feelings about.
But this is exactly what we were hoping to gain from you.
I don't know about that.
So this is very nice. So perhaps we can pass the mic on to Venerable Ananda.
Yes, yes.
So I will switch off temporarily here on our side.
So thank you very much, Ranjini Obeyesekara, for the wonderful lecture. And yeah, this is all. I'm switching off now, and thank you very much.